Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Edelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, sponsored tonight by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. They are probably the best known good cop, bad cop team in comics today. They are Gary Groth, the founder of the Comics Journal, and his partner in Fantagraphics and fellow editor Kim Thompson. Fantagraphics is a preeminent publisher of comics-related books and magazines, including the more than 30-year-old Comics Journal, as well as an extensive line of graphic novels, comics histories, underground comics, with an X or two, and comic strip collections such as Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes. So who is the good cop and who is the bad cop? It's no secret, actually. Groth, the founder of the company, is generally regarded as the bad cop, the guy who shoots acid from the lip and lets the cow chips fall where they may. Thompson, therefore, is generally regarded as the good cop, the guy who evens out Groth's rough edges. That, as in any case, is the reputation of the two guys atop Fantagraphics. The truth, I suspect, is somewhere in between. Gary and Kim, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
You guys still speaking to me after the introduction? Good.
I am, certainly. Gary, I don't know.
Click.
So, I mean, that's the perception of your partnership. I mean, is it wrong?
No, well, I'll let Gary defend himself.
I'm not sure I need to. I'm not sure I would defend myself. I might accept that.
Oh, really? That's going to be easy. Well, folks, thanks for tuning in, and come back next time for another. All right, let me ask you this. Who does what at the company? Titles seem a little vague, so I don't know.
You promised us you'd ask easy questions.
When did I promise that? Show me that in writing.
That's tough. I mean, we both do... You know, we overlap our responsibilities. We both do a lot of similar things. You know, we each have our own books. When we're actually editing a graphic novel or a book compilation, one of us usually takes on the primary responsibilities for it. So we usually divide that, you know, roughly half and half. And then we both take you know, a lot of responsibility for just the day-to-day operations. And I'm not, it's hard to say how it precisely breaks down because it doesn't precisely break down. We both cover each other. You know, we both deal with, you know, with all the stuff you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, working on the books, dealing with employees, dealing with the financial issues. I don't know if Kim could shed any more light on that. But
yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, there's certain areas. I probably handle a little bit more production than Gary does, but Gary does a little bit more of the managerial financial stuff than I do. So there are divergences, but we do work as a team, or we do work individually doing more or less the same things on different books.
Hmm.
It's pretty fluid, and it has changed over the years back and forth as well.
Well, and how did the partnership begin? How far back do you two go?
Well, we've technically been partners for, I think, over 30 years now. I think we've hit the, the company's been around for 32 years, 30,
The company was started in 1976, which would be 33 years ago, and we met in the fall of 1977, which means that we're coming up on the 32nd anniversary.
Wow.
And pretty much as soon as we met, within a very short time, we were actually working together. And then we officially, you know, legally became partners a little bit after that, but we were working together on, at the time, the magazine, the Comics Journal, the only thing we were doing pretty much immediately.
And, you know, what do you owe the success of the partnership? I mean, especially in the comics world, which I actually was in comics fandom in 76 and 75 when this thing started. That is, there is a lot of peace in that area, a lot of very strong personalities, a lot of guys who believe that they are always right absolutely about everything. How is it that you guys have, your partnership has endured all this time?
I think we're equally obnoxious. I think we've sort of reached a level where we can take each other's crap, and we always have that.
Which is almost a refutation of your introduction, Bob.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's true. You know, had there ever been any moments in all those years where one of you was like, "Ah, screw you, I'm out of here"?
There probably been a few hundred of those.
Yeah, I mean, at least within our own heads. never really spilled out farther, you know, to the point of like stalking into another's office and saying, "That's it, I'm out of here." But certainly we all have our dark nights of the soul and our, you know, we know how to push each other's buttons. We've had longer to do that than most married couples have. So there is that too. But on balance, behind it all, we know that we're pretty much stuck with each other because there's nobody else who would tolerate us.
it's like a good marriage. You know, we bitch at each other, we complain, and then we get back together and there's never any sex.
And we have only one child, a big, unwieldy, expensive one.
Well, now there was a period of time, and you guys can probably tell me exactly when this was, a couple of years back, where your business relationship may have been good, but the business itself was kind of sick and on life support.
That would be from 1977 to 2009.
Well, you can beat me through that. All right, but I'm thinking of a more specific time in the last, I don't know, what, 5 or 6 years, maybe a little longer than that, where you guys were literally asking people, help save the company, buy one of these damn books in our inventory, help keep us alive, contribute some money.
Right, right.
Yeah. that's correct.
That is correct, yeah. That was the only time we responded to the crisis that way, but there have been other crises that we dealt with in other ways. So pretty much periodically, we are up at the edge of the cliff looking down.
How long ago was that I'm referring to?
6 years ago.
Was that before or after Peanuts?
It was right before we started publishing Peanuts, I think.
Right, so that would probably make it like 2003, maybe?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Right before Peanuts, we started publishing Peanuts. That was the absolute bottoming out. There was a period of about a half a year to a year before that, when we were simply waiting for the first Peanuts money to come in, and we were just staving off everything until then.
Mm.
So in one sense, it was the worst period because we were the least financially viable, but we did have the light at the end of the tunnel of Peanuts beckoning us on.
But as Kim intimated, that was only one of many times when we were on the precipice. I mean, independent publishing is really hard, and it's financially grueling. And we went through periods like that many times over the last 33 years.
I was going to guess that the Peanuts and what we're talking about, folks who don't know, that Fantagraphics publishes. Has started publishing, I believe, from the beginning, collections of all of Charles Schulz's Peanut strips. And was that a turning point for the company? I mean, has the company been on more solid ground since that happened?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure. I mean, Peanuts is our best-selling book, and
it's our best-selling 12 books.
Okay. Is that right?
Like if we do a list of all our there might be a couple that sneak in, like around 8, maybe Ghost World, number 12, Palestine, and then that moves us. But at least only the top 5.
Has that success with Peanuts of all things? A company that publishes R. Crumb, for example, has that changed your perspective on what you publish or what you should be publishing, or has it not really affected that at all?
I don't think it has affected that. I mean, Peanuts was in keeping with what we've always wanted to publish, which was basically just good cartooning.
Mm-hmm.
And Peanuts just happened to be good cartooning.
Bear in mind also that we started publishing Popeye like in the 80s. So Peanuts wasn't exactly, you know, shot out of the blue.
Yeah.
Right.
And Prince Valiant in the 80s. So
right.
We were always interested in publishing what we consider to be good cartooning, and a lot of that was newspaper strips. And in the 80s, in 81, I think, we started publishing Nemo Magazine, which was edited by Rick Marshall. And we published 31 issues of that, and that published some of the greatest work from newspaper strips and editorial cartoons and so forth that's ever been done. So we were always interested in publishing a wide range of cartooning, not just underground comics or alternative comics or one sort of mode of comics, but the whole gamut of comics. So, and publishing Charles Schulz, who I think both Kim and I regard as one of the great one of the preeminent geniuses of the cartooning form, was not only a terrific catch commercially, but one of our dreams artistically.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that if we started publishing Peanuts like in 1985 or 1986, it would have been looked at with a lot less surprise than when we started doing it just a few years ago. I think what happened was in the 90s, we were so successful at a certain relatively narrow range of alternative cartoonists that sort of became our identifier. We became known more for that. But we always wanted to be more of a broad company and reach, in addition to that kind of post-underground type material, into the classic vintage comic strips and the foreign material, just all the way across the board.
And yet, from Peanuts, then you added Calvin. I think Calvin Hobbes came second. Is that right?
We wish we did, but we never published Calvin and Hobbes.
Why didn't I think you had the Calvin and Hobbes collection? Isn't that odd?
Maybe thinking Dennis the Menace.
Maybe. I don't know why. I don't know why I thought that. I mean, obviously,
it may be because in the wake of the Peanuts collection is when that big Calvin and Hobbes collection came out.
That must be it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So that might be far side.
I take that back. Yeah, of course, and of course, I guess, I mean, Universal, those are Universal products. I guess Universal published them. But, you know, there's a big difference between being the publisher of Popeye and E.C. Segar and Peanuts, in that, I mean, Popeye's always been around, but, you know, it's never, and the art, I mean, you know, the art was spectacular, but it's never had the reputation. It's never been, on the top of, so many people's lists, whereas anyone around the world can relate to Peanuts, which I guess is confirmed by the sales success that you've had with it.
Right, right. And don't forget, we also published Crazy Cat, which was Charles Schulz's favorite comic strip.
Hmm.
And that's the one that usually winds up as number one, you know, if it's not Peanuts.
How did you get the deal to do Peanuts?
Well, I interviewed Charles Schulz for the Comics Journal in 1997, I think. And I'd met him approximately 10 years before that. I interviewed him along with Rick Marshall for Nemo Magazine in the late 80s. And I wanted to do a really exhaustive interview with him, so subsequent to that. So I called him up sometime in the mid-90s and asked him if he'd be willing to do an interview, and he agreed. And it took me a long time to do all the research because there was no complete Peanuts to read, so I had to scrounge every Peanuts collection we could find. And then I read everything I could about him. And after doing the research, I flew down to Santa Rosa and interviewed him in his studio. We spent a day together. And we just got along very well, and the interview turned out very well. We published that in the Comics Journal. And we kept in touch, from that time. And I broached the subject with him after the interview. After I turned the tape recorder off, we were sitting in the ice rink that he owns near his studio, mm-hmm. and we were just chatting casually. And I just brought up the possibility of publishing the complete works of Peanuts. And at first, as was his wont, he very modestly said that he didn't think anyone would be that interested in reading the whole collection of Peanuts. And so I kept hammering away at him, and he finally said, okay, well, maybe it's a good idea. Why don't you, contact the syndicate and pursue it, which I did. And to make a long story short, he very unexpectedly died in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued talking to his widow, Jean Schultz, about it, and she was very enthusiastic about it, and basically made the project happen.
Was it, considering the what I gather to be the shape of the company at the time, was it a risk at all for you guys to commit to do something like that at a time when you're struggling, you know, as a business?
Well, no, I mean, quite the opposite. I mean, we knew that the publishing Peanuts would help our bottom line. And, I mean, publishing anything when you're financially in a dicey situation is difficult. But, the finances of the company kept, were fluid. They kept going up and down. I'm not sure exactly what shape we were in when we were, when we negotiated the deal. But I don't think that's something that we really thought about. I mean, that's what we do. We go to work every day, and we publish books, and we negotiate contracts for new books. And you can't just stop doing that because you're in a difficult position. Because if we did that, we would have stopped around 1979.
Right. Is the most of the publishing world at the moment is struggling. Book publishers, newspapers, magazines. By comparison to what we're seeing every day in the general media, how is the comics media holding up, whether it's Fantagraphics, the Comics Journal, or just in general? You know, how do you view the industry at the moment?
That's a good question. The feeling I get is that it's gone down a little bit, but not necessarily as much as some of the other parts of the publishing industry.
Yeah.
They've definitely got a little bit more feeble in terms of orders of backstock and a little bit more intense returns and everything, but there's nothing like really catastrophic about it, at least at this point.
Yeah, I guess my impression too is that the graphic novel, what has become known as the graphic novel, segment of the industry has maintained a better sales track record recently than other portions of the industry, and I guess that's partly because of the cachet that it's gotten over the last couple of years, the fact that it's been a growth part of the market over the last 3, 4, 5 years, and so the growth has diminished, but it hasn't stopped dead like it has in so many other genres.
How important is it that it's traditionally been an industry where people expect to hold comics, whether it's pamphlets or graphic novels or comics with an X or collections, they expect to hold them in their hands, and it hasn't really, I guess no one. Still there?
Was that a question?
I'm there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I heard you clear your throat, so I thought you were about to speak, so I stopped the question. Yeah, I was just saying,
sorry.
No one's really come up with a digital alternative that's as, I guess for most people, that's as attractive as holding comics in your hand.
Yeah, the problem is that the Kindle's still too small. So it's, they just came up with a new one, but even that one is fairly small, and the resolution isn't really that good yet, so... my suspicion is that once the technical aspect catches up with it, that it will be a fine way for viewing comics, just not yet.
Yeah, I think that the books are going to cohabit the universe with digital technology, and I think that the new Kindle is roughly as big as many comics. I mean, I forget the size exactly, but it's something like it's approximately 6x9, the image area.
The smaller comics, it's like mouse size.
Yeah, the smaller graphic novels, but there are a lot of them. And, I mean, technology is going to make reading comics viable on some electronic device. But, I think there are going to be a lot of people out there who still want a beautifully produced art object they can hold, they can show to people, The actual design and the packaging and so forth all come together to enhance the content. So I think somehow how it's going to shake down is that they're going to both coexist. I'm not sure what, you know, what percentage is going to take over, you know, which of those areas, but I think that's going to happen, and what you're seeing is that it is happening right now.
I think what they need to do with the Kindle and, you know, the Sony Reader, things like that, is have, you know, the one side, obviously, where you're reading your book, there's, you know, the text, and, you know, when you're reading a Kindle, no one can really tell what you're reading, but I think the other side has to be a digital display of the cover of whatever you're reading, so as you're going through the airport or wherever you are, people can see what you're reading, and you can show them how cool you are by reading.
That, I think, would work against graphic novels.
You think?
I think still so, yes.
Oh, that's sad.
I was going to say that they should just have a button where you can turn it on or off, depending on what you're reading and what how cool it is.
Or
maybe
even or fake one.
Or fake one, yeah, right, exactly. Just
maybe you could have Lolita on the outside while you're reading, I don't know.
Or vice versa, yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, yeah. See, that would work in, you know, an algebra class, right?
Right, right,
exactly.
There you go.
Speaking of content, and I guess I am now, what is the basic philosophy in terms of what you guys decide to print on the Fantagraphics side in terms of the graphic novels and everything else? You know, what makes it work for you guys?
I still haven't figured out the answer to that. It's basically what we like. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I've tried to extrapolate from that and say, well, because it's work that's unique or because it's work that's well-crafted or work that engages us this way or that way. But basically, it's stuff we like.
Yeah, you know, the longer I've been doing this and the more I, you know, the more we publish, I think it comes down to what I've decided is it's come down to a kind of stylistically unique way of seeing the world, and I think that sums up pretty much everything we publish or that we try to publish. That the artist has to have a perspective on the world that's unlike any other, and that communicates something significant about it. You know, I'm putting together. I'm up to my eyeballs right now putting together a 1,000-page, 3-volume collection of Gayon Wilson's work. And you know, he has a vision just as unique as that of Charles Schulz's. And I tend to think that's true of every artist that we publish to one extent or to one degree or another. I mean some is obviously better than others, and we try to publish a lot of younger cartoonists. We publish some of the older masters like Gayon Wilson or Jules Feiffer, Robert Crumb. But I think they all share that one thing in common, which is that they're interpreting the world through their own prism. And they have something to communicate, something worthwhile that they're communicating to the reader.
How does the reader discern, you mentioned the graphic novels, of course, that's the buzz phrase. That's what everyone gets excited about. That's what gotten everyone from... Penguin and Random House and, Norton, they're all involved in publishing graphic novels now, you know, comics and big hardcover books and beautiful packages. But, how does the reader discern what they're going to enjoy and what's just kind of the artist masturbating with a pencil?
Well, how do they determine which movie they're going to enjoy, which TV show they're going to enjoy? I think that's true whichever medium. In a sense, it might be easier for comics because as opposed to, say, it's a lot easier to flip through a comic graphic novel and determine if you're going to enjoy it than just to flip through a novel.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you mentioned a movie. I mean, we've got a nation of movie critics. There's a mini nation of comic critics. But it seemed like for the last couple of years that part of the move to the graphic novels has been, or calling them graphic novels, has been to drag in people who are outside the comics world as readers. And yet, I think sometimes people, they'll say, oh, I've heard of these graphic novels, let me pick up one. And they pick it up, and it's really hard for them to understand what in the world is going on.
Right, if they pick up the wrong one, then that's going to be bad.
Yeah, I think if we knew the answer to that, Bob, we'd be enormously successful as opposed to modestly successful.
I mean,
everyone wants to know the answer to that, and it's just such a, you know, such a cacophony out there that it's just so hard to, you know, to target. I mean, one of my dreams is that we both think we publish great books, and that if only more people were open to them or were willing to look at them or pay attention to them, we'd sell a lot more than we're selling, and a lot more people would enjoy them. But it's how do you find these people? I mean, there's so many distractions out there. It's probably a miracle that the people who do find our books, you know, actually do find them with everything else that's going out there to compete with them.
Now, the Peanuts books are probably reaching a broader audience than anything Fantagraphics has published before. Is that a safe guess?
Yeah, probably a different audience, too. I mean, an overlapping audience, but partly different from our traditional audience, yeah.
Have you guys figured out a way now with having several years of these, under your auspices to get that reader of those Peanuts books to sample other Fantagraphics product?
It's pretty hard. A lot of comic strip readers are not only loyal to just comic strips, they're even loyal to just one comic strip. So if you have someone who's like a Prince Valiant fan, Prince Valiant is what he or she likes, and you're not necessarily even going to be able to get them to read Popeye. Mm. It might be marginally easier to get someone who's reading the Peanuts strips, Peanuts collections, to move over and start buying something like a graphic novel, but only very marginally.
Are you able to, I don't know if the syndicate controls this, are you able to market a page or two at the back of those Peanuts books to say, if you like this, you should read whatever?
We don't do that. I'm not sure if we could do that contractually. It's possible. I mean,
we don't really do that with any of our books. I guess we sort of find it tacky to advertise within books, although maybe we should be a little less worried about that.
Yeah, well, of course we have our website fairly prominently listed in all of our books, but you know, it doesn't follow. I mean, I was naive enough, maybe in the 80s, to believe that if someone liked Popeye, he was going to like Love and Rockets, or if he liked Little Orphan Annie, he was going to like Dan Clowes's work. And that's just, I think we learned that that's not the case.
Mm.
That people, you know, there are a lot of people who like certain books, whether it's Peanuts or Popeye or whatever. And they're not necessarily going. That's not going to translate into liking something else that you might, that Kim and I might think is you know, an equivalent kind of cartooning. You know, I mean, I don't know the demographics. I think over the last 20, 30 years have been so compartmentalized in this country that's no longer the case. You don't have general interest magazines anymore. You have very, very specifically targeted magazines. And I think that's true of people's taste in general. That's why that trend has happened.
Is there anything you guys published 10 years ago that you would not publish today for any particular reason? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, are there things that you have published in the past that would not pass the sniff test today?
Flames of Gyro might not pass. I mean, generally, I think we've published things we published things over the last 33 years that we had, you know, on second consideration, we probably, you know, we might not have. But
also one of the things to bear in mind is that back in the days when we were publishing all the pamphlets and ongoing works, is that sometimes you'd find a cartoonist and think, well, the work he's doing right now really isn't that great, but we see potential there. And sometimes that potential was filled, sometimes it wasn't filled. And if you look like at the earliest work of, say, Dan Clowes, it's not necessarily that much better than some of the work by other cartoonists who started that level, but who just never evolved. So with 20/20 hindsight, you might say a couple of those comics, well, the guy never really went anywhere, so publishing those first couple of mediocre comics wasn't really worth it, but who knew at the time? And we thought it was always a gamble worth taking.
So sometimes you guys will you know, help a starving artist, basically, because you see potential there. Then
Yeah, I mean, we published a lot of young cartoonists. You know, we published, I mean, the Hernandez brothers and Pete Bagg and Dan Clowes when they were in their early 20s, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Hernandez brothers were kind of a different case because they were great from the very beginning. I mean, you go back to look at that first issue, and it's fantastic. But there are other cartoonists. I mean, there's one cartoonist I can think of that I won't name that, I mean, he did something like 10 years of crap. I mean, he just got very, very, very slowly better. I mean, he started off awful. We wouldn't have looked at him on a bad day. And he became, you know, worked his way up to mediocre, then to adequate. And by the time we finally started publishing him, he was really good, and he was one of our top cartoonists then. So sometimes there's that curve. And in his case, we did not sacrifice ourselves and start publishing the bad work of his. We actually sat around and waited for it to get good.
as we
stole him.
As we were discussing that, I was thinking of, I used to be a pop music, a rock critic for newspapers. And the thing I used to hear from promoters, and it's all changed now because basically you've gone from mom and pop promoters in your local community to, you know, two or three promoters around the country that handle everything. But when it was individuals, they would gladly, in the most cases, put on a show by, someone that was on a label but was, you know, kind of low level because they wanted to help grow them and they wanted that band to be loyal to them in 2 to 3 years when they hit their stride and they had their big hit. They wanted them to come back and play their venue. I guess the same kind of thing.
Yeah, to a degree, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things you're doing differently is you're about to publish, speaking of Schultz, Monty Schultz's first novel. I think it's his first novel, and it's the first, am I wrong here? Is this the first nonfiction without pictures that you guys have published?
You are wrong, Bob.
Oh, on everything?
It's not Monty Schultz's first novel. It's not our first novel.
Ah.
But I'll let Gary take that.
Okay, please.
Yeah, we actually published our first novel last year. It was by Alexander Thoreau. It was called Laura Warholic. Hmm. It was a 900-page literary novel.
Oh, my.
A huge kind of kaleidoscopic satire of modern life. And you're probably going to want to know why we published a prose novel. And partly it's because I've always wanted to publish fiction, and it's one of those things that I've just never been able to get around to because of all kinds of reasons, mostly having to do with time and money. And we originally published a book by Alex Thoreau. He wrote a monograph on Al Capp, and we published that, and he wrote a monograph on Edward Gorey, and we published that. And Alex had been an established novelist. He has several previous novels to his credit, as well as a book of poetry and a few other things, a couple of collections of essays. So he was a very, very well-established American writer. And he got tired of dealing with New York publishers and agents. And he just, after he published these two monographs, he called me up and asked me if I'd be interested in looking at this novel. And I was, and I thought it was extraordinary. And so we agreed to publish that. We published that last year. And then subsequently, I got to know Monty Schultz because Monty wrote a long essay for the Comics Journal about the biography of his father, written by David McKellis, of which he took issue with a lot of the things that the author wrote about his father. So he wrote an essay in the Comics Journal about the book and about his relationship to his father and what he felt his father was like as a father. And in the course of talking to Monty about the essay, he talked to me about his writing this novel called This Side of Jordan. And one thing led to another, and he basically sent it to me. And I have to tell you that I was worried when he asked if he could send me the novel because I figured I was in the position of rejecting a novel by Charles Schultz's son.
Yeah, right.
And I was trying
to
figure out how I would do that because I assumed it wouldn't be worth publishing. Because what are the chances of Charles Schultz's son being a brilliant writer? And so I started reading it, and within about 30 pages into it, I realized that this guy really knew how to write. Mm. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised. I read the whole book in a couple of days. And it's just, it's terrific. It's beautifully written. And we, you know, we agreed to publish it, and it's coming out in October.
Now, I've got an advance copy, and I'm expecting to have Monty on the show when the book comes out, and so I'm about 40
okay.
or 50 pages in. And, you know, at first I was thinking, I don't know, I was a little thrown by, there's a lot of all caps stuff, and, you know, in online we've gotten used to, well, when people write in all caps, they're shouting at us, and it's a little hard to read. But, yeah, I got about 30 pages, 35 pages, and suddenly I realized I was pretty well hooked on it. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, he really knows how to write. He's a very lyrical stylist. He was very influenced by a lot of the Southern writers like Flannery O'Connor and Carson McCullers, Truman Capote. And this is a great novel. If you're getting into it, you know that it takes place in 1929, right before the Great Crash. And he's created three incredibly vivid characters: Alvin, a 19-year-old farm boy. Who's naive and suffering from tuberculosis, a Chicago gangster who's involved in the in bootlegging, and a philosophically minded dwarf, and together they hook up and they sort of rampage across the border states, committing bank robberies and murder, and. And Monty did a tremendous amount of research, period research for the book, and you probably noticed that the language is all very authentically derived from that period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a terrific, I mean, it's just a terrifically written book that immerses you in that period and within the characters' lives, both interior and exterior.
Yeah, the error that it captures, especially the where it starts off with the dance contest and the
right.
marathon, it's like, yeah, you know, I haven't read much about that. And I mean, certainly, boy, it's so long ago now, 50, 60 years ago, there were probably people writing a lot about it, but it's not an era that many people pick today to write about that way. So, yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I can, as I looked at it, it's like, okay, you're publishing Monty because, you know, it's probably a gimme to keep publishing Peanuts. But from what I've read so far, I mean, it's a genuinely interesting compelling narrative.
Yeah, yeah. I told Monty, I said, you have to be careful because, you know, people are going to think we're publishing this because so we publish Peanuts and because of that connection. And we issued we actually sent out, I don't know if you got this, Bob, but we sent out a Q&A with Monty about the book, and we addressed the 800-pound gorilla in that Q&A and brought that up. But no, we're publishing it on its merits. And you know, I think if Monty sent us a really badly written novel, we would not have published it. It would have been a little problematic, but
Yeah, I'm sure it would have been.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about something else that you guys publish and on a regular basis, Malm, which I guess, Gary, you edit with Eric Reynolds.
Right, right. And Eric
now
does,
I'm,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and Eric does most of the heavy lifting on that. He does all the hands-on work, and I contribute by suggesting, you know, a handful of artists and consulting with him, but he does a lot of the work on that, most of the work on that.
Where does the name come from?
Well, it was someone who worked in our office. We actually polled everybody in the office. What do you think our anthology, the name of our anthology should be? This was about 4 years ago. And one of the people who worked in our office, I think it was Greg Zura, came up with the name. And we came up with, you know, it was like coming up with a name for your kid. We had like 30 or 40 options. And we just liked the way it sounded. I guess we liked the configuration of the letters. We thought it worked well for a logo. So,
is it kind of like one of those car company decisions where, or consulting companies where they come up with a name, a word that does not exist in reality, and it just seems to fit what they're doing?
Well, it does exist.
Oh, it does. See, that's what I was getting at. What is that? What, you know?
Oh, it means kind of okay, I'm trying to recall. It means something.
I feel better now.
I'm trying to come up with a good definition for it. I think it means a little doofus-like.
Yeah, a stupid or dull person, as I recall.
Yeah, a dullard.
Is this the part where I point out that the photo that we're running on the page for this is got a picture of Gary in a doofus T-shirt?
Yeah, right.
I'm not making this stuff up, kids. This is just, you know, they're just handing me the lines.
I'm putting that shirt on right now and taking a picture.
Gosh. And then, of course, I have to ask you about the granddaddy of all of Fantagraphics, which is the Comics Journal. Did you ever imagine that it would be publishing 33 years later? I mean, you've got your, 300th issue this year.
Right. I didn't imagine I'd be alive 33 years later. I was publishing the Comics Journal, so no. I don't think, we didn't have a 5-year plan, much less thinking about what we'd be doing 33 years later.
Has it changed a great deal from the initial concept?
Well, it has and it hasn't. I mean, it still retained, the core mission that I think we saw it having, which was providing literate, intelligent, and forceful criticism of the profession and the art form. But it certainly evolved over the years. It evolved from mostly only having mainstream comics to talk about, which was 1976 when underground comics were on the wane and alternative comics hadn't really yet come sprouted, to talking, about the more vital aspects of the art form as they've evolved over time. So, but I think the core editorial approach has stayed pretty consistent over the years.
Hmm. I have to ask you, I've been trying to figure out how I was going to ask you about this. Now, the magazine, I've got the description right here, the only serious scholarly magazine of comics news and criticism, and it has certainly brought a more serious consideration of comics and comic books, comic strips, comics, again with an X. And yet, one of the things over the years has been, one of the artists who tried to bring that perception was Will Eisner. But yeah, the sense I have and I've gotten from other people is that there was something about his place in all this or his work or something. I don't know what it is that, Gary, that you weren't real crazy about and that led to a bit of a fissure dealing with him and maybe even Dennis Kitchen and that whole group. Is that something you can address?
That's partly true. My relationship with Eisner was pretty casual. I did not know Will well. We started publishing the journal in 76. He came out with the contract with God, I think, in 78.
Right.
I know that better than I do. And my relationship with Will, was pretty casual. I mean, we would talk to each other at conventions. I'm sure I had a few phone conversations with him. And, what I remember is we actually exchanged faxes more than anything else. But I never interviewed him for the Comics Journal, although we ran some interviews with him. But when I wrote a review of his work, of his post-Spirit work, which was, I think, in 1989, a pretty negative review of his post-Spirit books, up to that time, the relationship became pretty icy, which is perfectly reasonable. To further answer your question, I thought that his post-Spirit work, the stuff he did from Contract with God on, was pretty feeble material. And I said so at some length. We sort of reconciled not too long before his death, I think, in a very informal way. But I never thought much of his post-Spirit work. I mean, I thought his Spirit work was terrific. I mean, it had so many great elements to it. not only the formal innovations that he created in terms of designing the page and creating content that was so much more mature than all the work that was surrounding it, but when he started doing his sort of tendentiously literary work, I think he really did lose his way. So I'm not sure.
He's been gone. I'm trying to remember. I guess it's 4 years now. And the last couple of things that he did, obviously, were long after you wrote that in 1989. But
right.
Things like Fagin and the plot.
Vietnam.
Did any of as you look back, and he's not here to discuss this, obviously. But as you look back on those works, any of those change your mind, or do they help balance the ledger in your mind in terms of his post-Spirit work?
No, if anything, the contrary. I mean, they just reinforced my earlier observations of his work. I think he had. I think all of that work displayed the same kinds of flaws, which was a kind of cloying sentimentality, overwrought, scenes. A kind of overreaching for kind of literary meaning that was just not in him. And, what was in him was playing with the form, playing with taking popular genres and incorporating those into his work and having a lot of fun with it. Which he did in the Spirit with screwball comedies and film noir, and he combined all of that stuff. It was just charming and funny and witty. And even in the Spirit, when he became serious, and I put serious in quotes, like with that Bernard Schnobel story, is that the right character? Gerhard Schnobel. Even that, that was. I mean, that again, he was flirting with. Dealing with subjects and interpreting things in such a way that I just don't think he was capable of doing adequately. All that stuff. You look at the Vietnam story and it's the Vietnam book, which was composed of, I think, four vignettes, and I think it's embarrassing work.
So maybe where some people have talked about him over the years as being the Orson Welles of comics, maybe you'd describe him more like the Woody Allen of comics, where his earlier, funnier stuff was the best, and the later, more serious, where he's trying to actually working to present himself as an artist, maybe not so good.
Well, he never quite had his crimes and misdemeanors, so I don't know.
Yeah, or husbands and wives.
Yeah. I actually thought that the Contact with God was pretty good, but it's like he almost reached the end of his rope pretty fast after that.
And outside of the comics world, what would be a counterpart for the Comics Journal? Would it be something like Cahiers du Cinéma or something else?
Well, it might be a Cahiers du Cinéma. I mean, I'm only familiar with that from like the 50s and 60s and maybe into the 70s. But that's probably a good analogy. I don't know. Let me see the Comics Journal. What would it be like? I'm not sure. It's funny because comics were at a place at that point where I don't know if any other art form was at a similar kind of cultural nexus.
Mm-hmm.
As where comics were at that time, which were that there were a handful of great, there was a handful of sort of cartooning masterpieces, but they were spread all over the map. They were, in various forms. There were comic strips, editorial cartoons, a handful of comic books. We just got off the underground comics, which people were still digesting, trying to figure out where they fit into things. And, and we started the Comics Journal, at that time. I mean, actually, at a time when comics had sort of hit a real low spot. And I'm not sure that there was any, you know, any magazine that focused on a particular art form that started in any place approximating that. So I guess I'd have to cop out and say I have no idea.
All right. I just got a couple more questions for you guys, and I'll let you go. You've been very gracious and patient with me this evening. What do you think is the fate of the basic, I guess it's been for several years, people have called it the pamphlet, the essential 32-page comic that basically Marvel and DC are best known for doing. Do you think that's got much of a life left to it?
I think for the mainstream still, yes. For the more alternative and graphic novel-oriented work, it looks like its days are numbered.
Yep.
It's just not a very comfortable delivery system for that type of work.
Hmm. If the Marvels and DCs and, you know, to some degree, I guess, Dark Horse and Image, if they were not making money off of movies and TV and that kind of stuff, do you think those pamphlets would even still be in print?
I think they still make money off of some of the pamphlets, at least. And even if the pamphlets only break even, at least they form the base material from which they can build graphic novels later. So it's hard to say. I don't really know what their finances are like. But I'm sure they do all right with the comics.
Okay. And as we're talking, this year's Comic-Con International is a few weeks off. How important is the San Diego Convention to the industry and to the Fantagraphics business in particular? How much do you A, look forward to it in terms of, you know, as publishers, but also as fans and, you know?
Well, I think we both dread it and look forward to it. It's pretty intense. It's a lot of work. it's sort of our presentation. It's, you know, here we are. A lot of people have a chance to see the work that we do. I don't know in the grand scheme of things how important it is, but it's like it's almost, it'd almost be more significant if you weren't there than being there.
Yeah, it's probably not very important at all.
it's probably a lot more important to movie companies at this point.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think publishers who go there and display actually make a profit by doing that. But, it's more of a social event than anything else, even though it's drenched in commercialism,
mm-hmm.
which is a weird kind of sick convergence, I guess.
if you skipped the show this year or next year, would it affect your business in any way?
Boy,
probably not.
Peripheral, you know, only sort of tangentially. What's weird is that it's sort of commercially meaningless and yet just so commercially driven.
I think I can safely say that we both do enjoy it because we're at the point now where we have a big enough company and enough trusted employees that if we wanted to, we could skip it, or Gary and I could. And the fact that we do return there year after year says something.
Yeah, I mean, mostly
possibly
I'd like
just that we're creatures of habit, but
yeah, I mean, mostly I just like to see people that I wouldn't get to see otherwise. I mean, that's its main value for me personally, and for the company, of course, we just want to have a presence there and be able to sell our books to the people who go to the convention and want to buy them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly every year there's at least two or three people that I really, really want to see, and it's a good chance to meet them.
And it gives our authors a chance to sit there and sign books and talk to their readers too. That's important.
And last question, really. Do each of you have any particular special or fond memory of a Comic-Con in years past? Something that's happened, or someone you've met, or just?
Well, we threw a series of parties before they sort of got out of hand, and there was one party that was so intense and crazy and fun that I remember that very fondly. It's a miracle no one died.
Okay.
Was that the party that took place on three different floors?
Exactly, yeah. And there are people, and I remember standing outside, and you could almost see the entire building throbbing and people just hanging out of windows and fire escapes. And if there had been a fire, half the comics industry would have been dead. That was awesome. Yeah, that was years ago. We've matured since then.
Uh huh.
We would never do that anymore.
Now you let somebody else throw the party.
I was going to say, unfortunately.
Yeah. So we can go to bed at 9:30.
All right. Well, let me tell everybody. You can find the Comics Journal and the wide variety of Fantagraphics books, from Peanuts collections to the Best of R. Crumb, and a couple of my recent favorites. I wanted to mention here while we're talking, the Wolverton Bible. I was a huge Basil Wolverton fan, and there's some great stuff in there. The collection of Sam strips, the Mort Walker, Jerry Dumas strip from the early 60s. It's just a great, great read for anyone who loves comics and wants all the inside breaking the fourth wall kind of stuff. And then Trina Robbins' recent book, The Brinkley Girls. Enjoyed all that stuff. But anyway, you can find all that stuff. You can find it at MrMedia.com and Amazon.com, or, got to mention, you can go to the Fantagraphics site. It's Fantagraphics.com. It's Fanta graphics.com.
And also check out the blog, because there's something going on the blog every day.
Oh, is the blog at Fantagraphics.com?
Yeah, once you're there, you can go to the blog very easily. And there's always lots of links to other things and interviews and drawings and all sorts of cool stuff.
Cool. I actually knew that, but I wanted to let you get a word in edgewise. Gary and Kim, this was. I hope the questions weren't too hard. I hope I wasn't too mean-spirited, and I hope you had a good time, because I did, and I really appreciate you guys coming on and joining us for the entire hour.
Oh, no. So did you figure out who the good cop was and who the bad cop was?
You know what? It's as I said in the introduction, the reality of it is always a little more blurred than people might think.
Yeah, it's a toss-up.
Yeah. I think I'm leaning towards, having spent an hour with you guys, I'm leaning more towards two pretty good cops, and I didn't really get the bad cop. So I don't know. Maybe we'll have to do it again, and the bad cop
there
can
you
come
go.
Out.
Do it again, and we'll both be in bad cop mode. That's
right. That would be cool. We'd have to do that. But anyway, guys, thank you very much. I enjoyed having you on.
Well,
and,
thank you. It was fun.
Thanks,
all right,
Bob.
Take care. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And for more interviews with your favorite comics, artists, writers, and critics, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Dave Gibbons, Monty Wolverton, Trina Robbins, Dennis Kitchen, Gene Colan, Mike Gold, Wendy Peeney, Joe Sinnott, Chuck Dixon, Peter Cooper, Drew Friedman, Daniel Pink, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant, Pointer Online, MySpace, Facebook, NetVibes, Multiply, Zanga, Friendster, Orkut, Bebo, Podcast Pickle, Vox, Folio, MediaFly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, PageFlakes, Eons, Mi Gente, Zimbio, or Odeo. Subscribe to Mr. Media in iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews within the podcast section of iTunes and click the free subscribe button. It's that easy. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. I always appreciate when you give up a piece of your day, or as the case may be, night, and spend it with us. Thanks for listening.